Welcome to The Creatives with Dana Porches. The Creatives is a new podcast exploring creativity through conversation. I'm Dana Porches, your host. If you want to know more about me, you can visit the podcast website at www.thecreatives.world. But the podcast is really about the wonderful and interesting people I meet. Brent Lambert has been mastering sound recordings for over 30 years. His studio, The Kitchen, located in North Carolina, has mastered records for well over 2,000 top-selling and indie artists like Cracker, Camper Van Beethoven, The DBs, and Southern Culture on the Skids. Their motto, "To realize your vision with our ears," says everything about how Brent and the Kitchen crew approaches the techniques of manipulating the artist's intent and performance and to bring that to our ears cleanly. Brent takes the time with me to explore in depth how mastering is done and how they are the last brush to provide the last mix to a great performance, which is what we get to enjoy every day. I'm really glad to have Brent Lambert on The Creatives today because I am really interested in sound. And sound and perception is one of those things. It's hard to put it into words. And I thought if I was going to talk to somebody about sound and what makes it so interesting as one of those senses, I'd talk to somebody that does something which is manipulates sound, because that's kind of what you do, Brent, at The Kitchen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, to varying degrees. Correct. Sometimes we just wave our hands over it and tell the person that did an amazing job, but that's pretty rare. Yeah.
The Kitchen, as I just referred to, is your business, but you're in the business of mastering. Maybe you can explain to us what in the chain of getting a record or getting a recording to us for us to listen to. What is a mastering house? What does mastering mean?
It means multiple things, and I'll start from the macro and go to the micro. The most pulled out perspective, I guess, would be the assemblage of disparate mixes. And of course, if for those that don't know, the three processes are recording, where you record the original performance. There might be a multi-track performance where there's overdubbing. And there's mixing, which is the person who balances all those individual recordings to make a cohesive, almost final product. And then mastering I always use this analogy. If anybody's familiar with film, it's pretty analogous to what a colorist does to the final print of a film. And that you're listening to all these disparate mixes and trying to make them work cohesively. And you may actually take into consideration the sequence of the songs and how the spacing between the songs, but also how the amplitude of the endings and beginnings relate to each other and how the relative vocal levels relate to each other. If it's vocal music, if it's instrumental music, you're trying to maintain some sort of consistency. And then there's the nuts and bolts and crossing your I's and dotting your T's part, which is putting it all together in a format that is ready either for replication, manufacturing, or for now, digital distribution. And each of those distribution channels now have specific requirements. So there's a technical component of it. That's not my favorite part. My favorite part is the artistic part of it, where you have to, and this gets tricky, sometimes if it's a really great mix, you have to really realize that you have to get out of the way and just sort of let it be its own thing. And that's good and desirable, because the better it comes in, the better it sounds coming out. Mm-hmm. The less I have to do, the better. On the other end of the spectrum, you might be handed a beautiful piece of art that's just really rough around the edges, and your job is to try to peel off the layers of the onion, and that's been used a lot in defining mastering, or just bring clarity to the mix. And that's where the artistry, I think, comes in that you're trying to interpolate the artistic intent behind what the songwriter and the producer put their efforts into.
Wow.
And not overstep your bounds and put your own sonic thumbprint on it. And that's tricky. And sometimes I end up putting my thumbprint on it. If I think that the artist doesn't really understand, or the producer maybe young and not really understand or know what they really want. And that's a tough call. And so I try to have as much of a dialogue as possible with the artist or the mixer or the producer.
Hey, you know what? You answered so many questions all in a row there. Other people that are listening may not totally get the whole story. There's so many things involved in sound, which is one of the main perceptions that we kind of overlook sometimes. And I want to go back over a couple of things that you said. The importance of performance, because if you don't get a good performance or a good recording, you can't perform your mastering or get something better than what was given to you. Is that correct?
I would say fundamentally that's correct. However, I do think that you can have a great performance that's been captured with a poor recording and a poor recording and or poor mixed and get in the way of indirectly engaging the listener. And I think that when something sounds great and you focus on what are the elements of that mix that draw you into the song, I mean, if you boil it all down, music is a form of communication. Mm-hmm. And my job, at least as my perception of my job, is to try to identify the things that will unconsciously or consciously invite the listener to really take a listen and engage emotionally with the music. And to me, that's where you can make a difference. But yes, if it's a poor performance and the integrity of the artist isn't there, or it's just not a moving performance, there's no magic I can do to make that any better. Mm-hmm. But I can take great performance and a poor recording and make it more engaging. And I have people before that they should consider re-recording or remixing, and they would be wasting my money, or wasting their money, if they had me work on it. And I do that. And that's changed over the decades. Because when I first started, the average professionalism of a mix that came in was quite high on average. And then as home recording and recording equipment became less expensive and more accessible to everybody, the average engineering skills went down quite considerably.
You think that's a learning curve? What you just said, so much of what we've gone through in the last year with COVID and people recording at home, all these bedroom artists, across the board, there's been an incredible jump in the quality, but people are mastering and doing it at home, which is
correct,
taking it away from what you do, but it doesn't elevate performance all the time, because you said it's a balancing act between the performance, the artist, the engineer, the producer, the masterer. Now, if you've got one guy sitting in a bedroom recording and doing all the instruments and multiplying it, it could multiply the problem per se.
That's true. And I do think more ears, depending on the project, and there are exceptions, I think that having more ears on a project is always beneficial. It doesn't mean that whoever's offering up an opinion is right. Mm-hmm. It's art. One correct way that something can be expressed, but I do think that is a really valid point. And you can sometimes tell there are solo musicians that control everything, and I'm not going to name names, but sometimes I do find that those projects are a little suffocating.
Do you wish at times that you could have been the one setting up the mics and recording? Because that's not what you do. That's not what you do.
Absolutely. Because that's the magic, to be there when the performance is laid down in the inception, if it's improvised, and particularly I love improvised music, to be there and capture it, that's the most exciting thing. Honestly, the reason why I got into mastering was totally business related and circumstantial. In a nutshell, return on your investment per square foot for a mastering studio far exceeds that of a recording studio.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. And then when I started, the gear was still prohibitively expensive. I mean, even for mastering, when I first started, you know, I had to have a 1630 machine, and that was, I bought a used one, I think, for close to $40,000. And, you know, then CD recorders came out. My first CD recorder was like over $10,000, and the workstation was like $30,000. And, you know, it's a lot of money.
Well, the evolution, you're talking about the evolution. I'm sorry they interrupted you, but I don't want people to get lost in the minutia of,
sure,
because as I said in the beginning, the history of what you're doing in mastering has changed so drastically in the last 30 years.
Yes and no.
How about we talk about analog and digital? Because when you talk about equipment, that's a big dividing line because of computers. Let's explain analog and how it progressed with you to where you are today.
To qualify, I don't really consider myself coming in during the total analog period, because the CD came out in 1979. That was, I think, the first year that the CD became a product you could buy. And so I didn't really start mastering until 1990, 91, around then.
Mm-hmm.
And so CDs were the de facto standard at that point. And prior to that, the major formats were, well, vinyl, of course. And vinyl lays are extremely expensive. And I didn't have the means to acquire one of those. And then secondly, cassettes were on their way out. I mean, there was 8-track before that, but cassettes were the other format. So CD was still the de facto format when I got involved. So I really was in that transition period. And I was at, the beginning of the cost-benefit ratio of, you know, equipment less expensive and you being able to provide a professional master to be replicated. And, you know, without a doubt, I gravitated towards the digital release only format when I got involved.
In really? Fact,
the serial number, yeah, not because I didn't want to do analog, it's just cost prohibitive. I could not afford get a lathe. However, I do use analog and primarily use analog gear for most of my signal processing still.
When you go to the picture of your studio, you highlight the fact that you use, now we call it vintage, real equipment.
Yeah.
But that equipment that you have and you show in your picture, now, when we talked about a bedroom musician or a person mastering, they can have that same equipment virtually.
Yes and no. A lot of my, almost all my analog equipment has been modified heavily.
Really?
Over time.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are great designs out there that don't need to be modified. A lot. In fact, I use several pieces of gear that you wouldn't really consider to be mastering pieces. But I particularly like the signal path or the way the transformers sound or how it sounds when you hit it different levels and then learn. And after years of working with it, I decide, well, I want this to sound a little faster on the bottom end, or I want it to be have an even lower noise floor or whatever it is. And I'm fortunate enough to know a couple of really great people that can modify equipment, and we change things and make it
electronics gurus, huh?
Yeah.
So then I guess what I'm getting at is that vintage sound, what people were brought up listening to, that the recordings of the 60s and sometimes mm-hmm. before that, that warmth of sound can't be recreated all the time digitally.
Oh, that's tough. No, I would say you can get really, really, really. Oh, you mean if it was a solely digital signal path,
right,
whether or not you could recreate right. that sound.
Is there a difference? There's a difference there, isn't there?
You know, I have a great friend and client in New Orleans. It's a great producer. His name is Mike Napolitano. You know, he is adept at getting that sound mm-hmm. and other sounds that sound very vintage. He used to have racks and racks of vintage analog. Like, go through and buy old Telefunken trees and all kinds of this vintage stuff to get that sound. And ultimately, in the end, he embraced digital because, you know, if you're using that stuff when you're mixing and you have an artist that wants a recall, and I don't, if your listeners that don't know, like if you create a mix and you send it out for review to the record company and the artist or the producer or the record company decides they want to change something and it's an analog mix, it's a real ordeal to recall that mix, you know, and even day to day, some of this older analog equipment sounds a little different slightly. Even if you wrote down the settings, it's hard to get them exactly the same. Anyway, to deal with on a day to day basis becomes very time prohibitive. And he ultimately learned that he could make those sounds now in the computer. And he got rid of like almost all of his, not all of it, but majority of his analog gear now mixes pretty much entirely in the box. And in fact, he captures audio much simpler than he used to because he finds that he can do it in the box. And his and it's interesting because his box is mixes sound pretty much like they did when he was just using all analog gear.
To recreate the sound of a room, they're now making what's called plug-ins.
Right.
I went and took a tour of Hansa Studios in Berlin. And then I find out that the engineer that worked on David Bowie's recording of Heroes, that specific sound that they got out of that room, the way they mic'd it, was so important in terms of the evolution of recording that they made a plugin that would make your recordings recreate that particular sound from that room. You can identify you can identify a room with your ears, most likely.
I can, yeah, and I can hear like if the room had drywall on it or was wood or not, you know, you can hear surfaces. I think all those things, when you hear a room and the reflections that come from the boundaries of the room, it makes you feel a certain way. I mean, if you think about how cold a gym locker room sounds or a shower versus an all wood room in a Victorian house or a concert hall, that's good or bad. And all those things have a definite impact on the music that's being recorded there, and how you use it in the mix is also impacts the way that the entire mix, the aesthetic of the mix, and how the listener is going to perceive it on the back end. It's a huge thing.
Well, now your business, the kitchen, does it have its own sound?
To answer your question, yes, I think I do have a sound when it's appropriate for me to go there. Other times I purposefully don't go there because if it's a classical recording or a really good acoustic recording, I try to stay out of the way and not impart any aesthetic on the recording or the mix because it's just, I don't feel like it's appropriate.
Do awards mean something to you in the industry? Does it bring you, you know?
Well, honestly, it brings you work. So, yes, being able to say been nominated for Grammys or, you know, it's about more about work.
But it's the artist, you know, isn't it the artist that's being considered? Because I know they give
the artist is.
Yeah, but you're part of that combination. Right. We talked about the artist, the producer, the engineer, the arranger. So,
yes,
there's a team concept here, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. There is. Yeah, absolutely. And definitely in working relationships over years, like where you have an artist or producer who works with a specific mixer and they work with a specific mastering engineer, there can be this communication and understanding of aesthetic that works seamlessly. And that's great. And it takes time.
What does a mastering facility look like in terms of the difference of, you know, people have seen what a recording studio technically looks like, a big room and mics and musicians laying around. What's a mastering room look like?
All mastering rooms have this in common where the bulk of the focus on the development of the room and in the equipment is on the playback chain. So all mastering engineers are to some degree or other an audiophile. And you want to make sure that what you're hearing in your room, where you're sitting through your monitors, is as accurate as possible. So the room has far less equipment in it than a mix room or recording room, because you're only usually processing two channels if you're working in stereo and you're working in surround, more equipment. But
I'm really interested in you've got over 25 years and thousands of records that you've mastered, the evolution of where you started into where you are now. How has that changed you?
How's it changed me in what respect? Personally?
Personally. I mean, you're going through a space in time, and it really is a change, because you mentioned you came in and you were listening to CDs. Well, I collect CDs, but I don't like the sound off of a CD. I have a 30-foot container full of vinyl. And yeah. there's a difference there.
There is.
And the specifics around how you compress sound onto a disc versus getting sound off the grooves of a record. One record sound archaic in comparison to a CD. So. Right.
And they're nonlinear, which is like from beginning to end, which I know a lot of people don't know that.
Explain.
Because the record spins and you have, it's a larger 12 inch diameter on the, if it's an LP, 12 inch diameter on the outside and the inside is a smaller diameter. It turns at a specific revolution RPM, so 33.33 or 45 typically, and therefore the angular velocity on the outer tracks is much higher than towards the middle. So on the outer tracks, there's a lot more detail, a lot more fidelity, and as you get closer and closer to the center of the record, it gets worse and worse sounding. It's just a physical limitation of the
You can hear format. That. But not everybody else. Aha.
Well, if I recorded an album and recorded the same, let's say a 3-minute song and recorded it over and over and over again, and then you put the needle on the first track and you put it on the last one and compared them, you would be able to hear that too.
Really?
And that's why,
wow.
And that's why back in the day, people would sequence vinyl records so that the last song would be the least important, or it would be like a more stripped down song, like the acoustic ballad or something that didn't have a lot of low end on it and wasn't loud and bombastic, typically, if they really knew what they were doing. And that's why singles were usually on the first one or two cuts on each side and not in the middle or at the end of a side.
Maybe that's why I collect mostly 45s.
Yeah, because 45s actually are maximized. Well, that's a smaller diameter. Mm-hmm. So you're giving up some fidelity because of that, but that's why they're also cut at a higher RPM, because mm-hmm. that gives you some benefits, that you gain some fidelity from that.
Interesting.
Yeah, and there's a whole art. I mean, there's a whole art to cutting good vinyl.
The LP concept has gone in the last year to an EP or single releases. How does that affect you? Because putting out an album and the continuity of the sound across all the songs, and front to back of an album, versus putting out one song. Does that give you more freedom?
I don't think I would interpret it like that. I find it more frustrating on my end because I will say I'll get singles and the artist won't intimate that single is going to be part of an album or an EP, or I'll get an EP and they'll not tell me that it's going to be part of an album. And then, you know, 6 months later, I get 3 or 4 more tracks and I go, oh, we're putting this together with that one. And they,
wow, that could be a problem.
You know, just the amount of time that was between when they mixed the first part and the second part, there's always some disparity between the two and it's hard to make them all work together. In fact, when I'm done with you today, I have to pull up an archive of a project from 2 years ago and marry it with an EP that was just finished this year.
Really?
And it sounded different. Now I have to go and rework the original one to make it work. And I don't like that, you know, and I understand why artists do that. And I think because of social media and the way that YouTube in particular works or any, you know, it seems like the frequency with which the artist's name and or social media attention becomes more of an important thing than the actual body of work. And it seems like people's attention spans are less. So and artists are rewarded by having their names pop up more frequently in Instagram feeds and Facebook feeds and YouTube.
It sounds like it's becoming less about the music, but about selling the survival. Selling the product.
Yeah. Yeah, and which, survival. You know, I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, 20, 30 years ago, well, in particular, like if you were a Nashville songwriter, you could write a great song and then collect checks and writing. Or if you were an artist that wrote your own, they can sell a lot of CDs. You could sell enough CDs, you know, potentially to buy a house, but that doesn't happen anymore.
How do you determine what is the right sound, Brent?
I'm going to answer that two different ways. One is a good musician, in my opinion, is a musician who's doesn't exist in a vacuum, but is taken in the history of whatever genre, the other, hopefully other genres of music as well, and then assimilated that with their own aesthetic preferences and come up with a personal aesthetic that honors things from the past, takes into consideration maybe new things and other disparate things, and that informs what they are and how they express themselves. And I think the same thing is true for mastering engineer, or like for me personally, I can only speak for myself, that I, like you, I've had thousands of, well, mostly CDs. I have hundreds of records. Not, I don't have a container full of records, but, you know, listening to music of multiple genres, for different, in different ways on different systems, and, that information in, and then marrying it with my own personal preferences, and not, and then feeling confident enough that your personal aesthetic choices are valid, and that happens over time.
So getting to know the artist is important, because you talked about genres of music. Like, for an example, to people listening, I listened to a sample that you sent to me of music across the board that you had worked on.
Right.
And there was acoustic music, there was, you know, not to genreize, jazz, not so much vocal. Each one of those subgenres of music, you had a different feel in terms of sound. So getting that sound is, how do you put it into words?
It's an abstract language, that's for sure. And the key thing you just said was, you know, the artist, again, it's about the artist and their intent. And the first thing I presume when somebody hands me a new project to work on is that they like it. And I asked them that question. I said, how do you like your mixes, or how do you like your project? You know, and are you happy with your mixes? And if they say, absolutely, I love it, then I know the intent that's easily identified in the mix is something I need to preserve. And then I adopt that, and I say, okay, this aesthetic is the aesthetic I'm working with, and I try to stay within that aesthetic, and then details or certain minutia within it to make it sound better. And honestly, in mastering, find that it's a lot of really, really little small details and refinements that make a big difference. It's not any major.
Well, you gave that example of giving three different samples, this, but again, like we said, that's kind of an abstract. Do you think your work pushes an artist, and have they ever come back to you and say, you know what, I got to go back and record this again?
Yes.
Interesting.
I have done that. I've worked on projects where I perhaps highlighted things in the mix that helped the, actually, can I tell you a story?
That's what I want you to do. I want you to do that. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So I'll tell you a story about one time. I don't remember how long ago. This is a long time ago. Maybe before 2000, I don't remember, around 2000. I was working on a single, an R&B single. I think it was for Sony or Columbia. I was an R&B artist, and it was in October. So it was a Christmas release, back when, you know, getting Christmas release was a big deal. Getting the CDs in the stores in time was a big deal. And the president of the A&R came down, and I'm forgetting his name, and I'm sorry, I forget his name. Anyway, we put up on it was an analog mix done at Sony on 56th Street or wherever it was in New York. And I don't remember the engineer, but I put the mix up. The mix sounded fantastic. And I, you know, just sort of polished it here and there. And I said, this sounds great. And he turned to me and he said, you know, this sounds fantastic. He says, but I just don't want to move. I don't want to dance. Like, do something to make it move. And I'm like, what do you mean? This mix is great. That should not have happened during recording. And he said, well, you know what? Let's play with a vary speed. And so for those of you who don't know, like a tape machine is, you know, it usually works at set speeds, 15 inches per second, 30 inches per second. Mm-hmm. And then I have a special variable speed tachometer or something that adjusts the speed of the motor that you can move in hundreds of percent. And we started playing with it to see if it would sound better. And, you know, I play with it for I don't know, 5, 10, 15 minutes, and I could make it sound different. I didn't find it any more engaging, but just different. And he said, I'm still not here. And I said, you know what? I said, and I was getting a little frustrated. I said, why don't you play with us? I'm going to go get a cup of coffee out in the lobby, and I'll just hang out, and you come get me when you're ready. And so he played with it for about 5 or 10 minutes. And then he comes, okay, come in and check this out. And he hit the switch, and it was like magic happened. Like all of a sudden, the song just had groove that made you want to dance. And then we're talking tenths or hundreds of a percent difference in the speed of the playback of the recording. And it was a real learning moment for me. I was like, wow, you know, that's incredible. You know, I would have never thought to go there and try to attempt to even envision that I could get that. And it really made me, and then I had a long conversation with him after. He said, well, yeah, he said, you know, he was a former producer, and I think he had worked with Barry White back in the days and in the 70s. And he said, you know, we used to spend a lot of time really focusing on tempo. And actually, that's something that's really interesting is that when most of my mixes came in on analog, I would typically get a sheet of paper that had very speed notes where the artist and the mixer might say, you know, this song should have been done a little faster, a little slower. And they would say, hey, make this one go up 0.11 or 0.096 or whatever. And I would get notes like that. And now that's gone away. Now everybody records digitally. Like I don't ever get very speed notes or anything about both. So maybe it's a period thing where people were more sensitive to how literally minute differences in tempo can either engage or disengage the listener in different ways. And there's actually I started researching, there's actually a really interesting academic study that was done. There was a PhD thesis done in Australia, and I can't remember the people that wrote it. But it was about correlating the resting heartbeat of females with the tempos of hit songs of a period of time. And they showed a direct correlation between the resting heart rates of females like in the 1950s and 1960s, 1970s, and how it related to beats per minute of hit songs, which I thought was really fascinating.
Really? Yeah. That's a great story, Brent. Thanks for sharing. I just put my hand over my heart because I want to see what my resting heartbeat is right now. I just drank a cup of coffee because we recorded here in the morning.
but I think the funny thing was it was females that counted, not males. So
we talked about the right sound, but the thing about what you do, I want to say there's character, there's attitude, there's color that you add. Maybe put that in perspective of what something like a term like compression does. Maybe explain to us kind of that, because you do compression, equalization. These are all abstract terms to people that don't understand that. You add something. It's like putting a light. What you do is sort of like putting a light on the music.
Yeah, although I think I would explain it the inverse. I subtract things.
Really?
I don't really add things. Absolutely. I think of mastering more like a sculptor being handed a big block of marble and you're taking what you don't need away. I've found over time that that's the most effective and least invasive and more hi-fi way of achieving the end product and the end goal. When you start adding things, I mean, there are times when you need to, but in general, if you looked at all my notes over the years, like pretty much everything is a subtractive process, not an additive process. There are some things I do with parallel processing.
What's that?
That's where you might take the original recording or a slightly modified version of it and then split it into two signal paths and then process one of the splits in a different way and then blend them together on the backside. And that might happen dynamically through a song where like in the verses, the ratio between the two might be different than in the choruses or bridge. And so I play around with those techniques. But in general, it's really about taking away what doesn't need to be there and or the things that are interfering with audibility or perceptibility of the most important and emotionally engaging aspects of.
So do you try to recreate live performance in the sound that you get? Because there's two different things going on. You have live recordings and you have, you know, recorded sounds.
I do. Yeah, I would say that's true if it's an acoustic recording, like jazz, bluegrass, or classical music. That's typically the goal. Like I usually will turn it up. Like if it's an orchestral recording, I'll turn it up to a level where I have a reference level where I know, like, this is how loud an orchestra gets, and this is it from, and I turn it up so I can hear that. And I try to make it so that, you can close your eyes and you feel like you're at that performance. Yeah. I do use that for a goal, but when it's an overdub type recording, popular music where it's multi-tracked and you've got these conflicting, psychoacoustics overlapping elements in the mix, I don't think that way for those type of record or those mixes at all.
You're going to tell me some of your favorite rooms, but I grew up and was able to share tickets. I grew up in Boston, so there was a lot of great old buildings there, but I grew up blocks away from Symphony Hall, Boston, where the Boston Symphony would play. And I shared tickets with somebody that had front row center at the back of the auditorium. And it was a place that would bring you to tears. So maybe tell me some places where you were in that space and it influences you now.
Yeah. Well, there are rooms in this area that I will purposefully try to look for, we're in my area in the Piedmont, North Carolina. We have three universities, more than three, a lot of universities nearby. Duke is here, University of Chapel Hill, NC State, and at Duke, there's a really great venue called Reynolds Theater. It sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went there and saw Brad Meldow with, oh gosh, I'm forgetting her name. Is it Diane Upshaw? Female classical vocalist. Anyway, they were able to perform acoustically. Sounded fantastic. And I've seen other music there with some minimal sound reinforcement, and that room sounds great. That's my favorite room in the area of all the rooms.
Thank you for sharing so much of your knowledge. I know I've only technically scratched your ear, so to speak, but I really appreciate you sharing. Brent Lambert from The Kitchen.
Absolutely.
A master at mastering. And I wish you a lot of success in the coming year. And you're going to be helping people in their sound as we come back into our environment and hopefully go to a club and hear sound again. But thanks to you, we have plenty of stuff to listen to. Thanks, Brent, for coming on.
Thank you. Take care.
Check out more about Brent and his studio, The Kitchen, at kitchenmastering.com. The Creatives is produced and hosted by me, Dana Porches, from beautiful Sonoma County, California. Audio production by Audio Ephemera. Be sure to check out our website, where you can find all our episodes, show notes, social media links, and how you can support the podcast. Visit thecreatives.world. Thanks for listening to the episode. There are so many more great interviews to come. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a single one of them. I am so glad to have you along with me. Bye-bye now. Next time on The Creatives.
What's going on is they're taking them down as an effort to stop the protests. Right. And what they're doing is warehousing them. But I know, for example, the Stewart statue, there is a family farm, a Stewart family. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it. Mm-hmm. But there is a farm in Virginia. And I believe a member of that family has asked to move the Jeb Stewart statue to that farm. There are other people who there's a cemetery in Richmond called Hollywood Cemetery, mm-hmm. which has a lot of Civil War dead buried in it. And they talked about moving them there. So it's not that people want to destroy them, but it's a complicated argument. I'm in an organization, and we're about to have a conference, and this is going to be one of the topics. And there is some concern about art historians trying to preserve these monuments. But what all they're trying to do is move them to someplace like a museum of the Confederacy, a museum of American history,